Welcome to DCEKG, where we diagnose Washington's policy issues and prescribe needed solutions. Join your hosts, Eric Ulland and Joe Grogan, along with leading in-the-room experts, as they shine a light on the black box of DC and break down healthcare issues and policy areas that shape healthcare.
Welcome to DCEKG, where we diagnose DC's policy diseases and try to prescribe some needed solutions. I'm co-host Eric Ulam, and joining me, as always, is my esteemed host, Joe Grogan. On this episode of DCEKG, we're going to delve into the disturbing trend of anti-Semitic riots unfolding at Ivy League universities, a trend that not only challenges the essence of higher education, but also seems to unveil deeply concerning undercurrents of anti-Semitism in our country. Our guest on today's episode is Tevi Troy, an old friend of the show, who currently is a senior fellow at the Bipartisan Policy Center, but also is a former Deputy Secretary of Health and Human Services and a best-selling presidential historian. He's also the author of multiple best-selling books, including Fight House, Rivalries in the White House, From Truman to Trump, which was named as one of 2020's top political books by the Wall Street Journal. Tevi, thank you very much for joining Joe and myself.
Eric, Joe, it's so great to be here with you guys. I know you guys think a lot about policy and how to improve things in this great country, and I am happy to have this discussion with you. And the one thing I would add to your great intro is that, yes, these riots are anti-Semitic, but they are also anti-America. These people are tearing down American flags, putting up Palestinian flags, Hezbollah flags, Hamas flags. And I think we should never lose sight of that. And you saw these kids on one college campus went and put up the American flag. And, you know, the protesters, rioters hated them. The cops in New York took down the Palestinian flag and put up the American flag where it belongs. And they get catcalls from these anti-Semitic, anti-America, pro-Hamas protesters. And I think we should recognize it again. 80% of the American people are on board. Now, I think it should be 99% of the American people, but 80% of the American people don't hate Jews, are pro-America, want this country to thrive. And then there's a small minority of people who are trying to destroy higher education and tear down this country in the process.
So great point, and thank you very much, especially for expanding it, that not only is this anti-Semitic, but it's also anti the United States. Why are we at this point? How did we come to be at a juncture where, especially after October 7th, the public reaction should have been sympathy and assistance to Israel after the heinous events? Instead, it's turned into or transmogrified into these public outpourings of disgust, anti-Semitism, attacks against Jews and Israel, and a real now set of bilious protests, campus on campus on campus across the United States.
Yeah, well, let me just say that the public response to October 7th was indeed sympathy and support for Israel. And again, the bulk of the American people are still sympathetic to America, to Israel, which is a democratic ally, which is on our side, which is not on the side of Iran, theocracy, destroying America, destroying the West. So the bulk of the American people are there. There is, however, this very loud minority, and I think they may be a majority on campuses, because campuses are choosing who they want on the campuses, especially places like Columbia. They're very selective. These places are taking 3-5% of people who apply. So a very small percentage of applicants get in, and they can have the pick of the litter. If they wanted to have just left-handed dentists, they could have them. But they are choosing disruptive people who want to tear down higher education, tear down the West, tear down America. And in the process, they want to tear down Israel and be anti-Semitic too. So these schools have selected who they want, and we are seeing that on our TV screens, unfortunately. And this goes back a long way, and I said we get into the history about this, but it goes back to the 1960s, where you had protests, and they were against the Vietnam War. There was some anti-Americanism in there, but it wasn't overwhelming. And those protesters did not single out one group on campus. It's not like they were going after South Vietnamese students and trying to attack those people, but unlike today where they're attacking the Jewish people on campus. And what happened was the people who were rioting and protesting in the 60s became the college administrators and the college professors, and they said, let's choose more people like us to come on campuses. Let's not pick the people with the best SAT scores. Let's not pick the people with the most highest potential. Let's pick the people with the highest propensity to riot and wreak havoc. And so they've been selecting for this over generations. It's Darwinian, right? I mean, if you select, it's a form of unnatural selection, I would say. If you keep selecting for this type of people, these are who you will get on campus. And so I will say, again, they are out of the mainstream of the American people. They're out of the mainstream of the Republican Party, which wholeheartedly rejects them. And they're not even a majority within the Democratic Party, although they're getting stronger and more powerful there, unfortunately. And so the colleges have said, this is what we want, and this is what they're reaping what they sow.
So we've seen this expansion of protests since mid-April 2024, and a clear allowance, and in some cases, overt encouragement from college administrators to set up these encampments, exercise the so-called First Amendment rights on campus, and encourage them to put their perspective, put voice to their perspective. But we've also seen now in the last week or so a counter reaction, not only in the general public, as you point out, with a very strong illustrative majority of the American people not supporting this, but colleges deciding that enough is enough and calling in outside law enforcement to clear off these protests, break up these tent cities and shanty towns, arrest these agitators and students and take them off campus. Why the relatively swift counterreaction from university and college leaderships across most of these instances of outbreaks of agitation and protest?
Well, first, let me make clear that it's some colleges have had this reaction. So I'll
totally agree.
Three camps. Some colleges, like our friend Ben Sass at University of Florida, said that you are spoiled children. This is not a daycare center. If you guys violate our policies, you'll be arrested, you'll be suspended, you'll be kicked off campus. So you don't have these problems there. Then there are colleges that have indulged it, and some under great pressure are now saying, okay, now we'll let the police in after you've destroyed buildings, after you've attacked Jewish people on campus, after you've caused grievous harm, and after you've hurt our reputation. And then there's another group, a cohort, like Brown University, which negotiated with these mini educator terrorists, and they agreed to increase Palestinian affairs funding, have more Palestinians come into the school, what else did they agree to? It was a whole bunch of ridiculous.
They're going to have a vote on BDS.
Right, BDS, reconsider their relationship with Israel. And so those schools are just completely capitulators. So the schools are in three categories. If you want my money, I'll choose Ben Sass. And I've been telling people for a number of years before October 7th that we need to rethink our relationship with these schools. And I say this as a Cornell graduate. I used to say proud Cornell graduate. I don't say that anymore. The Ivy schools were only valuable because there was a reputation that if you went there, you were considered to be smart and could also finish things. You had a stick-to-itiveness, an ambition, a drive. That's not the case anymore. You know, this goes back to public policy. 1971, there's a case called Griggs versus Duke Powers, Supreme Court case, where the Supreme Court said that employers cannot use intelligence tests to determine employment decisions. So the employer said, how are we going to figure out who's smart? Well, there are these schools, they're very selective, and they seem to take only the people with the top SAT scores. So let's go there. If you graduate from one of those schools, it's a sign, a signifier to us that you're smart. And so for 50 years, these schools have been pretty dominant. However, because of all these diversity attacks and because these schools are so left-wing and they want to bring more left-wingers in, they said, you know what? We don't want to determine who gets here based on their SAT scores, which is a proxy for IQ. Let's determine who comes here based on what we want to see come out of the campus, which is protest, disruption, and riot. So they're creating a system where they reject the half century of Griggs v. Duke Power derived reputations that they've developed as places where smart people go. And now they're developing reputations as places where disruptive people go. And there's a person, I can't even name him, but we all know him, who worked at a Fortune 50 company who told me, my company had a rule, we're not going to hire people from Harvard, Yale, Princeton. This is before October 7th. And they had this rule because those people were not coming out ready to work, ambitious within the workforce context, ready to advance the interests of the company. They were coming out and they wanted to tear down the company, and they wanted to dominate the Slack channel with DEI commentary. And they wanted to say, well, we don't believe in this capitalist enterprise. That's what they call it, capitalist, not capitalist. And so these schools now have a new reputation. And, you know, maybe it'll take a little time before Harvard loses its luster and Yale loses its luster, but it's happening. And a generation from now, when our kids' kids go to school, you're not going to say, oh, I want you to go to Yale or Princeton. You're going to say, you know, maybe you should go to Vanderbilt, or maybe you should go to the University of Austin, which is just developing now, or maybe you should go to the University of Florida or Hillsdale. I mean, there are all kinds of alternatives. There are great places to get an education in this country that are not dominated by this anti-American, anti-Semitic nonsense. And these schools have created the system in which they bring in the disruptors, and they, and often the administrators and the protest and the professors are part of the protesters. So let them all have it. I think these schools are no longer valuable. And I think from a public policy standpoint, we should think about whether they still should get tax deductibility for donations to the school if they have $50 billion endowments. Why do they need tax deductibility? So I think there's a proposal through, in Congress that says if you have an endowment more than X billion dollars, then maybe you should no longer get tax deductibility for donations to your college. I would support that.
Yeah. So, Tevi, let me ask you a question. Too here about this intersection of, I mean, you referred to the companies that are recruiting kids from these schools and they're finding out that they're anti-capitalist. You see historically totalitarian movements, whether it's fascism or Marxism, getting intertwined with anti-Semitism on their way into power, right? And a lot of their rhetoric on these campuses, like the students, I'm confused as to which campus it was. Just in the last 24 hours, they're standing up and saying, oh, it's not just about Israel. It's about U.S. foreign policy being a war machine. And it's about imperialist American foreign policy. It's about capitalism exploiting people. And it's all intertwined with this neo-Marxist view that seems to be dominating so much of the debate on American campuses. And to your point, coming out of the Ivy League, it's producing kids who hate the companies that they've been employed by. And do you have a view on this? I mean, how worried are you that this anti-Semitism is like a leading indicator of an even larger problem? I mean, you mentioned it being anti-Americanism. It's not just like, oh, we disagree with American foreign policy. It's like anti-foundations of the United States from the rhetoric they're talking about. How big a problem is it beyond, I don't want to say just anti-Semitism or U.S. policy towards Israel, but, how much of it is intertwined with this neo-Marxism?
Yeah, it's a smart question, as always, Joe. And there is an issue here. Like, Jews are often the canary in the coal mine. Anti-Semitism doesn't mean that a society is anti-Semitic. It means the society has underlying problems. They're looking for scapegoats, and they choose the Jews. And if you want to find a Jewish Marxist who in a, let's say a right-wing authoritarian nation to point to the Jewish Marxist, you can. And if you want to find a right-wing capitalist, if you're a neo-Marxist, that you can point to a Jewish Marxist. But you can also point to a non-Jewish Marxist, and you can point to a non-Jewish capitalist. But the Jews are easy to isolate and scapegoat and point to. So these movements, these dangerous, authoritarian, anti-democratic, anti-freedom movements often pick on the Jews because it's easy to isolate and point out the Jews. But they are indicative of a larger problem. And I will say one more thing on this, and this is something I've written about. I can send you some articles for the show notes. Countries that kick their Jews out, whether it's by force or by making them unwelcome, those countries suffer. This goes back to the Spanish Inquisition. The countries that kick out their Jews, they lose a sense of vitality, and they lose some entrepreneurship. They lose sometimes some of the smartest, most creative people, and they suffer as a result. This happened in Tsarist Russia. It happened in Hitler's Germany. They kicked out all the people who could have made an atom bomb for them. If they hadn't kicked out the Jews, they would have beaten us to the atomic bomb. And it was former scientists from former Nazi countries who were Jewish who were at the leading edge of creating the atomic bomb. So these countries kick out their Jews. It also happened with the Arab countries, by the way, after 1948. There were 800,000 Jews who lived in Tunisia and Egypt and Syria and Iraq, all those countries kicked out their Jews, have those societies thrived since then? Have their economies done well? Have they produced Nobel Prize winners? No. They kick out their Jews and they lose a sense of vitality. And it's not necessarily just about the Jews. It's about becoming a more closed-minded, less entrepreneurial, less innovative, less open society. And that's the danger. If we have that here in America, that would be a really sad day for the country.
Well, it's happened. I mean, I know anecdotally of Jews who've moved to Israel, and I've heard of people who've said, look, I don't want to live. I know of one instance, a Jewish family left Detroit because they were sick of it. And, you know, this is before October 7th, and said there's a rise in anti-Semitism around here, or I'm moving to Israel. I've heard and met people in other instances, Jews who've moved to Israel because they sensed a rise in anti-Semitism here in the United States. But let me pivot just for a moment, if we could talk about
one thing, Joe. You're totally right about that, and I certainly know people like that. But it's not yet a wholesale movement. And once it happens at scale, that's when you start to see the tipping point within the countries. And it doesn't just happen with countries. If universities kick out their Jews, they will also be more closed-minded, more authoritarian, less open to new ideas, and the universities would suffer as well.
So, Tevi, quickly, Joe, before you turn to the next topic, are there examples in history where this sort of trend has been arrested? Or if there aren't, then what do you think is necessary to arrest a trend like this?
So I do point to the 60s, where you did have urban riots in every summer of Lyndon Johnson's presidency. People don't talk about that. Every single summer, there were urban riots. You also had multiple terrorist incidents. You were constantly having bombings from places like the Weather Underground. And so the 60s were a very tumultuous time. There was definitely a strain of anti-Americanism in the protests against the Vietnam War, and certainly in what the Weather Underground was doing. But it calmed down. And I was actually talking to my brother last night, who's also a historian, and what ended it? I pointed to Gerald Ford's pardon of Nixon. When Nixon left office, and then Ford pardoned him, that kind of tamed the partisan passions of the time. Shortly after that, Jimmy Carter was elected, which, you know, people on the left wanted. And so by the time Reagan comes to office, you're not seeing the same kind of tumult and disruption. Now, also, maybe people get sick of it. People grow up. They get married. They have jobs. You know, although I don't think these people on college campuses are headed towards marriage and jobs anytime soon. But so these things can stop. But I do think there should be a multi-part plan. And I think we should look at, A, the funding that these universities get. So maybe less funding from gutter might be a good idea. Also, who is coming into these countries? We're letting in a lot of students from countries that hate America. Maybe we should rethink that. Third is we should rethink who's being admitted to schools. Maybe you should be admitting people based on their qualifications and their intelligence and their test scores rather than their likelihood of disruption. I think we should also do that thing I mentioned about on the campuses. You limit the amount of tax deductibility if you have these multi-billion dollar endowments. So I do think there are some policy steps we should consider going forward to try and send things in the right direction. Also, we should enforce visa laws. So if you're in this country and you are a citizen, you have First Amendment rights. But if you are an illegal immigrant, if you are on a student visa, there's all kinds of people where you don't necessarily have First Amendment rights just to be here. I mean, if you're a tourist, you can't walk around yelling death to America. Only citizens have that First Amendment right. And so maybe we should be enforcing about that. We should do more careful vetting of people who come into this country as immigrants. If you are pro-terrorist, if you are anti-America, maybe we should rethink about whether you're the person who should be getting a very sought-after visa. A lot of people want to come to this great country, and we should be encouraging bringing in people who want to build up the country, not tear it down.
So you brought in the historical context, and that's where I wanted to go next, and draw this distinction between free speech and violence. So obviously you're a public intellectual, you speak and write widely, a huge fan of the First Amendment. You make your livelihood off the First Amendment, frankly. What we see at Columbia, what we see at UCLA is violence, right? And you see disruptions of the kids who want to go to class every day, and that's being prevented by a lot of these people setting up human chains, blocking off academic buildings, setting up tents, being incredibly disruptive. The administrations, to some extent, in many instances, are canceling classes. They're kowtowing to the students and hoping that if they are allowed to camp out long enough, they're going to get tired. You reference Ben Sasse and his position, which was, look, we're all for the First Amendment, but you're not setting up tents. You're not going to be taking bullhorns in, and you're not taking over academic buildings. Very clear rules. When you think about the historical context, it seems like the right and the left have drawn different lessons from those college campus protests in the 60s. And tell me if I'm wrong about this, but on the right, you would say a lot of those protests got out of hand in some instances, and it sort of broke higher education in some ways that they felt like they had to cater to students too much, and that the law and order needed to be job number one on college campuses. On the left, there seems to be a romanticization that those protests, even when they were violent, and many of them did get violent on some campuses, that it brought about an end to the Vietnam War, hooray, hooray, and it affected real social change. And those college campuses and the violence associated with them were somehow successful, and that college campuses need to do more to learn from students when they go batshit crazy on campuses. Is that too simplistic a view of this, or what lessons did the right and left learn from the 1960s that led us here?
Yeah, I don't think it's too simplistic at all, but I think there's two things going on. Number one is this issue about what is free speech and what are the limits of free speech. And obviously my ability or my freedom to wave my hand ends when it hits your nose, right? I mean, you can't yell fire in a crowded movie theater. There are all kinds of limits on action. Whereas in speech, I love the First Amendment. I revere the First Amendment a lot more than the ACLU does these days, right? I think anybody should be able to say what they want. So you're right about the lessons the right and the left learn, but there's something else going on, which is for the last 10 years, since 2014, these colleges have not been bastions of the First Amendment. Again, these are dominated by left-wingers. There's not a conservative anywhere to be found on these campuses. And for the last 10 years, all we've heard about are microaggressions. Conservatives can't speak on campus at all, or they get shouted down or kicked out, including Supreme Court justices, including leaders of foreign countries, including conservative public intellectuals, some of whom are friends of mine. These people get drummed out, driven out. If you say anything, you say the wrong pronoun. If you say anything that might be interpreted as anti-gay or anti-black or anti-trans, you are completely canceled on these campuses. So 10 years of we don't believe in the First Amendment at all. The First Amendment is not a value on the left. Then all of a sudden, 2024 rolls around and these people are using violence and disruption. And they say, wait, First Amendment, you've got to be absolutely committed to the First Amendment in the most extreme interpretations that I think are incorrect. And so all of a sudden, when you criticize the Jews, the First Amendment is the hill you're dying on. But for 10 years, I didn't hear a thing about the First Amendment from these campuses. There's only people on the right saying, hey, what about the First Amendment? Charles Murray, maybe he should be allowed to speak on campus. So I think there's this complete hypocrisy on the left by these leftist administrators, these leftist professors who suddenly see the value in the First Amendment only when it's coming to cries of gas the Jews, kill the Jews, and go back to Poland.
And value in the full First Amendment, Tevi, because as you know, part of this whole epic of last decade or so has been the immense adoption of speech codes on campuses, which does further the agenda of driving voices to the sidelines or out of the arena altogether, and favor other voices to continue and expand inside the political arena. And so that's another piece of the puzzle of how this has been approached until this moment of crisis comes where, again, the full flower of the First Amendment is supposed to protect not just speech, but action by people who are agitating, not just against Jews, but against the United States as well.
Amen. Totally agree. These speech codes are egregious. They're anti-First Amendment. As I said, I'm committed to the First Amendment more than the ACLU is, right? The ACLU, I used to disagree with them a lot of things, but they were committed to the First Amendment in all forms. And now they have this theory that the First Amendment is to protect left-wing speech, but not conservative speech, not anti-Semitic speech, not anti-Israel speech. It only is committed to protect the speech that they like. And that, my friends, is not the First Amendment.
Are there any lessons, Tevi? You're a great student of the presidency and lessons to be learned from the way presidents behave in certain crises. How's Biden handling all this? How's the White House handling all this? And what's going on in the Democratic Party right now?
Biden, in my humble opinion, is doing terribly. I mean, if you look at asking his approval rating on the Israel-Palestine issue or the Israel-Hamas issue, it's under 30%. Nobody likes what he's doing. I heard this great story that there are these anti-Israel Hamas protesters on campus. And there was a pro-Israel, pro-America rally at the same campus. And they were each chanting F Joe Biden because nobody likes what Biden does. And his problem is he's trying to be all things to all people. And so right after October 7th, I actually publicly praised him for saying supportive things, the kind of things you were talking about, Eric, about Israel, for going to Israel and say we support Israel against these bloodthirsty, savage terrorists. But since then, he is becoming more and more critical of Israel, more and more anti-Israel. He said Israel is acting over the top in defending itself. He did not defend Israel at the UN with that egregious non-veto of the anti-Israel ceasefire resolution. And he is taking an approach that I think is extremely problematic, more beneficial to Iran than America or to Israel or the Saudis or any of our allies. But at the same time, the left is calling him Genocide Joe. So what you have to do in politics, I understand that you want to get the largest percentage of people, but you have to have some spine, some principles, standing up for something. And what Biden is standing up for is backing Israel to some degree, but then giving as much support to Hamas and the terrorists as he can. And that means both sides hate him. And that's why his approval rating is under 30% on this issue, but also hovering in the 30s on everything. I mean, he is just doing a terrible job, and not just because he's old and infirm, but because he cannot put together a consistent point of view. I mean, look, he's staked his presidency on Ukraine. He's never given a speech saying what's going on in Ukraine, why the stakes are important. The campuses are on fire. He hasn't made any coherent statements on, supposedly he's going to give a speech on anti-Semitism next week. But I promise you, that speech is going to be on the one hand this, but on the other hand, we have to recognize the rights of the Palestinians and Israel is being over the top. So he's not going to be able to have a coherent point of view. And it's because of what you said at the end of the question, which is what's going on in the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is increasingly anti-Israel, hostile to Israel. I mean, I do this series of debates around the country with Rabbi David Saperstein, big liberal, but we're good friends. And we go to these different communities and we talk about whether the conservative approach or the liberal approach is right for American Jews and for America itself. And he's always saying, oh, it's just these four members of the squad who are critics of Israel. The rest of the Democratic Party is not like that. Well, did you see that statement that Nancy Pelosi, who was the Speaker of the Democratic House for multiple years, signed that was very critical of Israel? It's not just the four members of the squad. It's a lot more than that. It is a big problem within the Democratic Party, and they are going to have a heck of a time trying to come up with platform language that that is not too hostile to Israel on the one hand, and is not too anti-America in being pro-Hamas and pro-terrorist. So I think the platform fight on the Democratic side is going to be ugly. I think the protests outside the Democratic convention in Chicago are going to be ugly. And I think they're sowing what they reap.
Well, wait, before we get to the platform, which we definitely want to discuss the platform situation, but he's sort of riding a tiger here in two respects, right? Because the Democratic Party has sort of invited the squad in, not repudiated the squad's positions on Israel, allowed them to voice opinions that are not just anti-Israeli, but anti, you know, capitalism frequently and very fringe in a lot of respects. They haven't repudiated that. And then all during the 2020 riots, they seem to be condoning these riots, and they unleashed this tiger that's running around. I mean, these movements BLM, a lot of these groups were very well funded. Young people get fired up about rioting. They don't just disappear. I mean, there's money still sloshing through the system. There's reports of these professional agitators that have been getting funding through this whole period, coaching these students. And I had, to your point, I haven't heard Biden give a really strong law and order speech about prioritizing open liberal education on college campuses versus silence and hate speech. I mean, there's a place for protest. We all agree with that. And students should be able to speak on any subject they want. But it's the law and order breakdown. It's the riots that I think the Democratic Party has lost control of, not just the anti-Semitism stuff. And to your point, they're going to be going ballistic this summer over not just Israel policy. These rioters are going to be going nuts about everything. Marginal tax rates, Trump, law and order, more defending the police. I mean, I just don't see how they roll in to the Democratic convention and don't have a real mess on their hand on not just Israeli policy, but also the law and order issue writ large.
Well, it's like the point you were making earlier about the lessons learned from the 60s. And one of the lessons that the Democrats learned is that protest is the greatest thing, and we value protest and we love protest, and it doesn't matter how violent it is, it doesn't matter how disruptive it is, it's all to be celebrated. Well, you know, pro-Nazi protests in the 1930s were not a good thing, right? Pro-Nazi demonstrations and pro-communist demonstrations in 1917 that led to the Bolshevik Revolution, not a good thing. So a protest is just a tool. It's not necessarily inherently a good thing. And I think you're right that they did learn the wrong lessons from that in celebrating protests, even when protests can go very, very wrong. And the other thing is, you know, you guys worked in the Trump White House. You know how much criticism Trump got for saying good people on both sides after Charlottesville. And, you know, I think it was deserved criticism. But, I mean, Biden's like constantly saying good people on both sides when you've got much more widespread and more dangerous and more anti-Semitic protests that are constantly happening here.
So, Tevi, just for the record, he also condemned both sides when Chancellor Charlottesville happened in 2017. I want you to put your historian hat on for a moment, though. Part of the 60s, as that all unfolded, was a complete reorientation of the Democratic Party away from being a tough national defense party to, as McGovern said in his acceptance speech in 1972, come home, America. And they had a devil of a time for a couple of generations in trying to work out who they were, what they believed, what they stood for, and how their both domestic and international policies would look in future years. Are we seeing that same sort of wrenching now going on with the Democratic Party as a result of what Joe just kind of outlined? And with kind of your future cast on, if that's truly the case, what is the Democratic Party both going to look like and stand for here over the next several years?
Look, I think it's a great question. This is a historical tension within the Democrats with the most radical elements. And then you've got the so-called moderates who, if you call Joe Biden a moderate, I don't think he's that moderate in my particular view. But yeah, I mean, and then you say you had the McGovernites win in 1972 because they understood the new rules of the primary process. And it was a historic disaster for the Democrats. They got wiped out in that election because McGovern and his ilk were just way too left for the American people. And what I think, my future prognostication hat, is I think over the next 10 years, the most interesting fight in America is going to be within the Democratic Party, within its insane left and within its so-called moderate wing, which, you know, is way too left for me, and I have a lot of problems with it. But at least, you know, they don't wholeheartedly reject America. They don't embrace anti-Semitism, and they are not for this pro-Iran foreign policy. So I think they are going to have a fight unlike at a level of intensity that I don't even think is going to happen on the Republican side. I know there's, you know, the so-called MAGA forces or the non-ones in the Republican Party. I think when Donald Trump is off the stage, I think the Republican Party reverts to something, not exactly what it was before, but it becomes something that's somewhat coherent within the slightly different positions, but it kind of coalesces again. I think post Joe Biden, and we're starting to see it already, the Democratic Party frays and shatters. And I don't think we're going to have the same Democratic Party 10 years from now that we have now.
Well, the thing is, you talk about what Trump's effect on the Republican Party, but I think it's Trump is a unifying force for this bizarre coalition on the left. And like Biden historically was very pro-Israel, right? And we saw, I think it was a kind of a watershed moment when Senator Joe Lieberman died a few weeks ago. He really came out of a tradition that you would say a thoughtful tradition of Democrats who were pro-Israel. Obviously, he was an Orthodox Jew. But he was very pro-America. I mean, I may not have liked his views on marginal tax rates or a lot of issues, but you didn't doubt whether the guy loved the United States, right? You see Biden, I mean, to the extent that I know he's not all there, but he seems like he's struggling with this, and he's surrounded in this White House with, I think some of the incoherence is because he's surrounded by a White House that's incoherent, staffers that are incoherent and all over the place. I mean, there are reports of a great deal of tension between career staff and politicals, among politicals in this administration around Israel policy. And when they lose the unifying, they lose one, this generation, the Joe Lieberman Biden generation, post World War II, New Deal, Democrats, that, you know, that tail end of it, and Trump leaves the stage, that's when they fall apart. Like, they just, their hatred of Trump, their irrational loathing of him is holding them together. Pelosi did a great job with her coalition, but I think it's fraying already to some extent.
Look, you're totally right. I mean, AOC has said, I can't believe I'm in the same party as Joe Biden. And if we were in Europe, we would never be in the same party. It's only in the American system that those two people are lumped together. And hatred of Trump is part of it. So, yeah, I think the Democrats are in for a world of hurt over the next 10 years as they try to figure out what they stand for. And I don't like either vision, but there's one vision that scares me a lot more than the other.
So in relation to vision, you mentioned party platforms a little while ago. Let's turn to that, as Joe framed the potential challenges in Chicago again for Democrats this summer. Let's talk a little bit kind of what your perspective is on party platforms. Why are they important? They sound super old-fashioned, but nevertheless, they do play several key roles for political movements on each side. Let's talk a little bit about especially both the public vision that a platform reflects, the unifying nature that a platform is supposed to reflect amongst all the various voices inside each party, and how campaigns and presidents use party platforms, or in some cases ignore party platforms, in pursuit of their policy goals.
Yeah, so I wrote a long article about this for National Affairs where I looked at the history of party platforms. And I started with a story. There was a guy I worked with in the Bush White House. You guys probably both know him. He's African-American, grew up in the South. And around 1980, he asked his uncle, what party do I belong to? And his uncle took the Democratic Party platform and the Republican Party platform, ripped off the front pages because these were printed things. It wasn't like it's nothing like today where you just print it off the Internet. I mean, these would be printed as documents and distributed and in bound form, ripped off the front cover of each. And he said, read each one and tell me what you think. And this guy read both platforms and said, oh, I like this one. And that was the Republican Party platform. This guy became a lifelong Republican because of it. The party platforms, they're not perfect indicators of what a party is going to do, but they are pretty good indicators of what parties want you to think about them. What are their values, what they're trying to pursue, what are their ideas, and what are the various counterbalancing elements within their coalition? And as you know, Eric, I know you've worked on multiple platforms. They are a kind of a negotiation of different parts of the party because different people are trying to get their ideas in. And the way to put a platform in is kind of complicated, where you take sometimes bullet points, sometimes speech rhetoric, sometimes op-eds, and you kind of meld it together in something that everyone in the party can get behind. So they are unifying in that sense, but they're also clarifying. I mean, is this the party that's for racial quotas or against racial quotas? Do we want to raise taxes or lower taxes? Do we support the Democratic ally Israel and want Jerusalem to be the capital? Or do we want to criticize Israel and say that Israel doesn't have a right to exist? I mean, these are important questions. The platforms can tell you whether a party is for this or that. And the problem that I saw in 2020 is the Republicans, and part of it was COVID, but not all, was the Republicans chose not to put out a platform. Now, as a candidate, if you're the presidential candidate and your party doesn't have a platform, that gives you a lot of flexibility, right? You could pick this position, you could take that position without being called out on it. But it also makes it hard to sell the party vision. And so people are like, well, I don't know, is this the party that I believe in? Because I don't know what it stands for because it doesn't have a platform. Now, if you have a position in the platform, let's take George H.W. Bush and No New Taxes in 1988. It doesn't mean that the party won't violate that position. But it does mean that if they violate the position, if they go against the position, there is a cost imposed for doing so. You either suffer because people say, hey, well, why did you violate this? Or you have to explain it. You have to say, you know, I understand this was the position in the platform, but because of exigent circumstances or because of new realities, we went against it. But at least you have to explain why you are deviating from the platform. So I think the platform is very useful for us as conservatives to hold the Republican Party to a particular conservative vision. And without it, then the party can go in directions that could potentially be problematic.
So, well, definitely take your point that H.W. Bush paid a significant political price for violating his No New Taxes pledge. By 1996, you had a Republican presidential candidate cheerfully admit he hadn't read the party platform and might get around to it at some point. I don't think he ever did. And we've certainly seen in both the W. Bush presidency and the Trump presidency, a lot of policies pursued and executed that weren't consistent with the party platform. And neither of them seemed to pay much of a price for not following every jot and tittle of the platform. Well, I take your point about the unifying nature of a platform and putting your perspective and views out there. I wonder whether or not a platform is all that meaningful in this day and age, given how modern politics have continued to evolve.
Yeah, well, so I understand that Bob Dole in 1996 said he hadn't read the platform, but Bob Dole's problem within the Republican Party was that conservatives didn't believe that he was on board with conservative ideas. And so his saying, I didn't read the platform, was his way of saying, I don't like this conservative platform. So I think that hurt him with conservative voters. And also, remember, Bob Dole didn't win. Let me talk about another candidate who did win, was Abraham Lincoln. When Abraham Lincoln died in 1865, he had a copy of the platform in his pocket. He sure read the platform. He knew what it said. He was part of crafting it. So the platforms, I think, are extremely important, and I'd rather take the political lessons from Lincoln than from Dole.
I guess we'll see here in 24 and afterwards exactly how controlling a platform really is and what, if any, political meaningfulness it had.
Well, you let me take on to this for a second. There's another thing that you alluded to, which could be interesting to witness, which is the fights over the platform. You know, if the Republicans follow your advice and issue a platform, it challenges the Democrats that they have to do one, right? I mean, I think their tendency would be to do one. But if they're really having a bloodbath and Republicans haven't done one, maybe they would say, ah, screw it, we're not going to do one either. If Republicans do one and can write a coherent document that lays out a vision, then Democrats are forced to confront some of these issues around Israeli policy, maybe around college campuses, maybe around law and order, that could be very difficult for them to navigate.
Well said. I don't disagree with a single word. I think that the Democrats are going to have a bloodbath on their hand, both metaphorically when it comes to writing the platform and then physically when you have these protesters and rioters in the streets in Chicago. And we've started to see over the last 10 years deviation between the Democrats and the Republicans on the platform on the question of Israel, which started off our conversation. For about 20 years, there was kind of this bipartisan consensus where both parties would put in pro-Israel language. But in 2012, the Democrats were reluctant to put in pro-Jerusalem language into their platform, and it was kind of forced through by voice vote, even though if you listen to the voice vote, the Democrats didn't actually, the pro-Jerusalem forces didn't actually win that vote. In 2016, David Friedman, who became the ambassador to Israel in the Trump administration, he worked behind the scenes to put forward some very pro-Israel language that really telegraphed what was going to happen in terms of the recognition of Israel, the recognition of Israeli sovereignty in the Golan Heights, and really set the stage for the Abraham Accords by not highlighting the Palestinian issue, but saying that there are larger issues of peace and development within the Middle East. And I think that was a very successful move to seed the policy proposals in the platform. And then he was able to carry them out in the administration by pointing to the platform at multiple instances during his time in the administration.
Where do you see the Jewish vote going? What's the trend line? You know, it's always been baffling to a lot of conservatives that Jews are not more aligned with the Republican Party. But do you see that this summer and the October 7 nightmare is playing out to have democratically aligned Jewish voters rethink that and explore voting for Republicans and Donald Trump this November.
Yeah. So let me say a couple of things on that. And obviously, you guys imagine I've spent a lot of time thinking about this. Look, the Democratic Republican split among the Jews is basically 70 Democrat, 30 Republican. And there's some consistency there. The Jewish community in this country tends to be more urban, more likely to live in blue states, gets married later, more likely to go and get graduate education. All those are signifiers of Democratic voters. So it's not just because they're Jewish that they vote Democratic, but they happen to have a lot of overlap with key demographic areas for the Democrats. The second thing is that just because the Republicans are only getting 30% of the Jewish vote that's not necessarily a limiting thing. When what I found in the study of the voting patterns is when the Republicans can get over 30% of the Jewish vote, that's a very good sign for Republicans. I don't think Republicans are going to get 50% of the Jewish vote anytime soon. But if they get into the 30s and even high 30s like Reagan got or Chris Christie got when he was running for governor of New Jersey, that is a disaster for the Democrats, especially in key counties like Cuyahoga County in Ohio. The Republicans did pretty well with the Jewish vote in Cuyahoga County in 2004, and that really doomed John Kerry's chances. And that was because George Bush stood up strong in the war against terror and in the war against Israel, the Intifada that was taking place at the time. So I'm not looking for Jews to get 60% Republicans to get 60% of the Jewish vote. I'm looking for Republicans to get 35 to 40% of the Jewish vote. And that, I think, would be demographically very problematic and politically very problematic for the Democrats.
When you're talking with other Jewish intellectuals, you're going around in these debates with your liberal rabbi friend, objectively, how can you look at this record under Biden versus Trump and how Israel is done? If you care about Israel, and I say this as an Irish Catholic, Irish American Catholic, I mean,
who loves Israel?
I mean, look, peace. What's wrong with peace? Abraham Accords. I don't get it. I mean, it's the scariest time in my life, and I can remember the Iranian hostage crisis when there were all those when the images of Americans held hostage in Tehran during the Carter administration, and we're on the verge of like a major, major potentially nuclear conflict in the Middle East. How are Jews defending the Biden administration's record right now?
I'll give you a great story. So you mentioned my debates with Rabbi Saperstein. We were in Chicago recently, not long after the Iranian attack on Israel. And I just knew with 100% certainty that he was going to credit Biden for defending Israel with the missile defense shield. And of course he did. And I was ready because I had done a little research and I said, well, it's really interesting that now you're supportive of missile defense, because in the 1980s, Joe Biden was against missile defense and so were you. And I read a statement that he had signed saying, we are members of the faith community and we have no faith in Ronald Reagan and the Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI, or Star Wars. And I read that in front of the crowd. And even he laughed because I had busted him so badly.
That's awesome. That's one of those precious debate moments that you live for, right?
And that's why you always got to do your research and your preparation. At whatever level you are, you always got to prepare for these things.
Well, speaking of that, you do a tremendous amount of research in all your pieces. And you've got a new book coming out that's available for pre-order on Amazon. Could you talk to us about that for those listeners who may want to purchase a copy?
Yeah, the book is called The Power and the Money. It's a history of relationships between CEOs of major American companies and American presidents. This goes back to John D. Rockefeller. I also look at J.P. Morgan, and I look at Henry Ford, Henry Luce, but I come all the way up to today with Zuckerberg and Musk and Bill Gates. And there's been this constant tension between CEOs, between major corporations and the political sphere. On the one hand, presidents want to hang out with CEOs and get staff from them and get social media help like the Obama campaign got from Zuckerberg and Facebook in its campaigns, and of course get campaign cash. But on the other hand, CEOs and corporations are sometimes useful political targets, and the presidents want to go after them and criticize them like Teddy Roosevelt did to John D. Rockefeller in the early 1900s. By the way, after Rockefeller was already retired and no longer running Standard Oil, but Roosevelt was still targeting him and going after him. So this book has all kinds of amazing stories about how these CEOs have navigated the waters of Washington. And also particularly interesting to you guys is how in the 1870s and 1880s, CEOs who were trying to create a company or an empire, they had white space with which to operate. They could do pretty much what they wanted without the federal government interference. Now, if you're a CEO, the federal government tells you who you can hire, whether you can sell your product, what countries you can trade with, what levels of tax you're paying. There are so many ways in which the federal government constrains companies. It doesn't prevent them from making profits, but it does mean that they are making political decisions, meaning decisions based on the policy of the United States that pushes them in certain directions for, let's say, sustainability or DEI or what have you. The government is increasingly kind of hijacking companies through its policies to get companies to accomplish government ends. And the CEOs have to navigate that.
And Tevye, isn't it the case that because of this push coming from government and all these tools that government can use, some companies are adapting to that in order to find the best advantage to model their businesses in relation to those directives or mandates and seize a competitive advantage by ensuring that they are the most compliant, they fit the most with those government regulations and diktats, and thereby predominate other companies they're competing with in their class?
It's absolutely true. And then sometimes you have a CEO like Elon Musk, who is basically made by government mandates, right? It's first SpaceX is made by a visit by Obama to the launch platform of SpaceX. Nobody had heard of Elon Musk at the time. And then also the green initiatives in the Obama administration helped lead to the subsidies for Tesla that helped make Musk a multi-billionaire. But Musk starts to speak out and he's pro-free speech and he buys Twitter, and suddenly the Democrats don't like him so much. So, playing with government can get you a lot of success, but it can also put you in a situation where now he's being investigated by the FTC and by the Department of Labor. And there are all kinds of tools that government can use to show their disfavor with how you are acting.
And he's got a consent decree. He's under a consent decree with the SEC, I think, that the Supreme Court just rejected as well. So Tevye, you've got the book coming out. Have you figured out what the book beyond that is yet? You're always working on something. Or what's the next article?
Yeah, I'm actually, you guys might have some insights into this, is I want to write something about the tension between Karine Jean-Pierre and Admiral Kirby in the White House. There was a New York Post report about how Anita Dunn tried to kind of force Karine Jean-Pierre out because she's not that great at her job. And Karine, I love it. They wanted to put her someplace where she couldn't do too much harm. So they wanted to send her to Emily's List. Did you see that, Eric?
Indeed, I did. Yeah. Pretty funny.
It was very funny.
Or Planned Parenthood.
But Karine Jean-Pierre basically said, I'm not going anywhere. And, because of demographic concerns, they really can't force the issue. I mean, when the Bush administration no longer wanted Scott McClellan, Josh Bolton told him it was time to go. But they feel incapable of doing that. And I want to look at the history of tensions between, let's say, press secretaries and communications directors and what it tells us about what's going on inside an administration.
Oh, looking forward to reading that. Yeah.
Great. So I'm always looking about the next fun article, the next book. As for the book I'm going to write next, I always, when I finish a book, I always promise my wife this is my last book, never telling the truth because I'm always going to write something else. But right now I'm in that hiatus period before I start the next project.
Well,
I got to cite my mentor, Ben Wattenberg, who I worked for, and we were talking about another public intellectual who was always a smart guy and well-known, but was always putting out books. And Ben said to me one day, that guy would be twice as influential if he wrote half as many books. So for years, not always the best idea. You got to let these things seed for a while. And so I'm going to give a couple of years before my next book comes out.
Well, I look forward to the next one. as I'm sure Eric does, and then I look forward to the one after that. Thanks so much for joining us, Tevi. This is always a blast. I love talking to you every time, whether it's over coffee or the phone, and this has been both educational, as every conversation is with you, but also a lot of fun. We want to thank our sponsor, Survivors for Solutions, our producer, Lauren Timmerman, and executive producer, John C.Z. Swartacki, our distribution partner, Big Wig Media, and our production team at Evergreen. On behalf of DCEKG, this is Joe Grogan, along with Eric Ulan. Thanks so much for joining us.
This has been DCEKG. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss the next episode. While you're at it, leave us a rating and review to help others find out about the show.